I'm going to ask Mark Ruhlman if he would come and introduce our guest speaker and his family for this morning.
So thank you for allowing 128 to join your class this morning. We were going to have these missionaries in our 128, and we just thought, why not expose them to a greater audience? And so if you've talked to Lorianne at all in the last 4 years, she has told you about her sister and her family and her four redheaded nephews. And we're excited to have them. They're back in the States for a few more months and in this area, so we thought we'd have them come and share with you guys this morning. They were instrumental with Lorianne and I as we were dating. Lorianne lived in Yelm, I lived in Marysville, and the Molseys lived in Tukwila. So they were kind of a midpoint for us. We'd both meet there and enjoy time just getting to know each other and getting to know them for myself. So just good friends, and just excited to have them share their ministry in Togo with you guys this morning. So Ethan and his wife, Melissa.
Well, good morning.
Morning.
Thank you very much for having us. We thought, just by way of a brief introduction, we'd both talk to you a little bit, and then we'll do our presentation at the end. If you have a few questions, then my wife, who knows more about what we do, will come up and answer those. So we're Northwest people. I always say that because we actually spent, well, we'll go back a ways. Melissa and I met when she was in medical school or getting ready for medical school, and I was in seminary at the time. So I lived in Tacoma. She lived up here at the UW, and she eventually went through medical school. We got married the second year of medical school. But she grew up as a pastor's kid. Her dad, and of course, Lorianne's father, pastored for many years. I grew up in northern Idaho, and so we spent 2 months in Togo when she was in medical school. She got to do a rotation there. And we came back and said, that was wonderful, but not for us. We're Northwest people. We want to go hiking and fishing and hunting and maybe Alaska. So we spent some time searching for other places to serve that would be less dusty and hot. And God kept bringing back to us the project that was happening in Mongo, northern Togo. And so we're back there now. Melissa works she worked here for 2 years after medical school as a...
So I'm an internal medicine doctor by training, so I'm a generalist for adults. And so I practiced for 2 years in outpatient practice. But moving to Togo and working there, I do everything except surgery, pediatrics, some OB, and of course taking care of the adults. So I've been stretched a little bit that way.
It's kind of funny how God uses all parts of your background in different parts of your life. I grew up in a small business as a young person, and then went to University of Idaho in Moscow and got a degree in marketing, and then later went to seminary. And you know, actually, it's a lot of my business stuff that I use now, as well as the seminary stuff sometimes. But I would never have imagined when I went to Togo that I'd be doing a lot of human or HR problems. So it's fun, though. They're very different problems than you have here. You don't have someone calling here and saying, I couldn't make it to work because an elephant stood on my cell phone. And so maybe sometime we'll write a book on HR problems in Africa because they're strange. Yeah. What else do we want to share before you sit down?
No, I finished residency, I worked for 2 years, and then about 5 years ago, we left for language school. Togo was a French-speaking country, so we left for language school. It's been a year and a half in France, and then went directly from there to Togo. We spent about 3 years there, so we're gone about 4.5 years. We're back in the States for a year, doing our home assignment, updating our churches, and talking about what God's doing in Togo, and then we'll head back in May for another 4 years, Lord willing.
If you get anything out of this morning, it's that God can use anyone, because I am a country kid from North Idaho, from a logging town. Most people where I came from, they don't expect you to leave Idaho, so they don't give you any foreign language. So I didn't have foreign language in high school or college, and so for us, going to France and learning French was a challenge. And there were many times I said it's a good thing we ended up going to their language school in France and not in Canada, because I could have driven home from Canada. So my mantra, which isn't a bad mantra, became there's only one honorable way out of that, and that's right through it. So we made it through French somehow, and we can speak all right, sort of.
And should I speak?
Yeah,
so in Togo, I work both in the hospital and I work in the clinic. I work about 4 days a week, and then we have four boys, 11, 8, 5, and 3, and so I'm with them the other days of the week. We have a school for our missionary kids, about 20, 25 kids on average, and have a teacher who teaches them, so I'm thankful for that. Yeah, that's the rest of our, we have two of our oldest here, and then the two youngest are in Sunday school. So yeah, it's a great blend. I really am thankful, number one, because I get to meld medical stuff with just being able to pray with patients. They come to me, they're mostly Muslim, as Ethan will talk about later, but they come to us for medical care, and then we're able to share with them the hope of Jesus Christ. And it is such an awesome way to blend really, truly what Jesus did. He healed people and he taught and he shared hope. And so that's exciting to be able to do that in a place where we can blend both of our backgrounds and our training and also be able to raise a family there as well. So.
Thank you. Okay, well, I am not the doctor part of us, so if you have questions, like I say, we'll raise our hands and we'll discuss questions later on. I'm going to go through a few things. Because this is Sunday school and y'all like feeling stupid in school, I have a quiz because I didn't know where Togo was even the first time I went there, honestly. So here's a few things. What is the size of Togo? Give us a guess. A, the size of the U.S., B, the size of Texas, C, the size of Washington State, or one-third the size of Washington State?
D.
You guys are very educated. You're correct. Lots of homeschoolers or private schoolers in here, obviously. What country borders Togo? Benin, Nigeria, Ghana, Canada, or all of the above? Okay, this is kind of a trick question. Yes, you're right. I'm hearing some right answers here. So C, Ghana is on one side of us, and actually A, Benin is on the other side of us. So that's a little tricky, I suppose. Washington's population is roughly 7.3 million. What's the population of Togo? 1, 4, 7.5, or 10 million? 10, 7. You know, actually, it's a C, so it's 7.5. So basically, one-third the landmass of Washington State with roughly the same population. Togo is a long, skinny country, so basically there's an area where it's about 30 miles wide. It's the same distance as the Canadian border down to Eugene, Oregon, and that trip would take you about 14 hours probably in Togo. Togo's most important cash crop is peanuts, coffee, tobacco, cotton, or lentils. We were recently in the Palouse, so that's why lentils is on there. That's not the right answer. Any guesses here?
B,
coffee. There is some coffee there. You know, the first time we went to Togo, I bought Togolese coffee and brought it back as thank you gifts for people who had contributed to us. And then partway through, I had some extra left over. I made myself some coffee, and it was really terrible coffee. So they might have good coffee. But actually, that is one of the crops, but D, cotton, is the most popular. So this is, of course, picking of cotton there is a very manual job. They pick it, they put it in their little, well, I don't have a picture of the barn there, but eventually this big cotton truck comes by. It's a huge all-day process where they load this, they stomp it down manually, and then they'll tarp this load and they'll drive down the road, and if you're behind them, it's the one time in Togo when it actually feels like you're in a snowstorm, or looks like it. There's Togo's flag and the size of our country. Just to give you an idea, if you know someone in Africa and you come to me and say, my friend's in Africa, do you know so-and-so? And I say, I don't know them. It's because Africa is kind of a large continent. So all of the United States, China, India, and pretty much all of Europe fits inside of Africa. So, but you can still ask. We might know if it's a missionary. It's a pretty small community. There is Togo, the little tiny color there you can see. Very small country in Western Africa. So we live in Mongo, which if you take Togo here, Mongo's to the very top. To arrive in Mongo, you would fly from here. Well, there's a couple options, but most regularly we fly from here to Paris, and then we transfer there and on to Lomé, which is at the very bottom down here. And that's about a 24-hour travel time. Once you arrive in Lomé, you get there in the afternoon. It's too long of a drive up to Mongo. And so you would spend the night. We usually spend an extra day, get some supplies. It's the only place you can buy cheese in all of Togo is in Lomé, as well as butter, I think. So we stock up, and then you head north. It's about 8 to 10 hours up to where we live, depending on the roads. Basically, there's one paved road up through Togo because they use this route to bring supplies into lots of Western Africa. And so the road is sometimes under repair. And for them, when they do it, the repair on the road, they basically go out in the field next to the road and they plow a dirt road for sometimes 10 miles and just parallels the road, and then they can work on the road, which works fine until rainy season comes, and then it gets a little treacherous. We've been stuck in some of those mud bogs. And of course, along the way, there's just lots of potential accidents. This is a bus that crashed just outside of Mongo, not far from our hospital. And it was actually our first kind of large mass casualty event we had at the hospital. We had 21 other soccer kids come into the hospital. Along that road, there's just large trucks all day long. These trucks mostly were, they lived a nice life in Europe, and then they were exported to Africa, and they left their brakes in Europe usually. And so they arrive in Africa, and then they're just always broke down. So they're broke down beside the road like this. You'll see them changing out a transmission, just kind of parked in the road for days, transferring something out. This load is really large, even by our standards. So this size of a load, typically there's a young man who would ride the 8 hours from Lomé up past us on the top with a stick, and he lifts the power lines and things over the truck. This is kind of a sad picture. This is a whole truckload, and I think this one behind it might be as well. Those are Muslim prayer mats, all heading into northern Africa. So you see loads of these every week come through. You don't need cattle trucks there. This is a Toyota Corolla with a cow or bull in the back there, nicely. That is very common, and I always wonder how they can get these guys in there without actually breaking a window. Togo life. I like to say our life in Togo is very similar to your life. You say I couldn't live there. I said that at one point too, but really it's pretty much the same. You guys have pets. We have pets. You know, we don't have a dog because we live in a Muslim culture, and so a dog would be a barrier because it's an unclean animal. But Aaron's had as many as 5 chameleons in his cage out front. When it's really been buggy, and before we had a screen door on our house, there was one time we actually invited him to bring the chameleons in, and they sat on the kitchen counter and zapped bugs off the counter. So they can come in handy. Yeah, we wear these shirts, which are really, you can go to Ross's or Kohl's and get clothes, but we actually go and buy fabric in the market, and then this gentleman takes the measurements, and he makes you something, and he doesn't usually understand how large white people are, so sometimes I take mine back a couple times and say, I'm not that skinny. You guys go to the Safeway meat market or whatever. This is the meat market we go to, but you want to make sure you get there early before the flies are too long on that meat, because it makes it a little interesting. Vegetable, produce aisle, Safeway once again, same thing we got. Winco bulk foods, I don't know if you have Winco. Joanne Fabrics, right? Ladies. Panera bread. Now our bread's not quite as safe to eat. You want to take this stuff home usually and roll it over the fire on our stovetop to make sure you kill anything that was on the outside, because you don't know who touched that. But Starbucks, yeah, it's actually way cheaper than Starbucks and not nearly as good. In this case, excuse me, once a week I go out to the villages with one of our chaplains, and so he always wants to stop excuse me, for coffee on the way, and so I offer to buy because it's like 10 cents a cup or something like that. But down here we have a pot that's the river water, unfiltered, pretty murky already. So it's boiling, so I know it's hot enough, and then they just take and add Nescafe to it. It's actually pretty dreadful, but it's as good as we get. And there's the river that the water comes out of, and that's on a weekend when it's also becoming the laundromat and the bathhouse. So sadly, the water intake for the entire city comes right out of this river as well. Hopefully upstream and not downstream of that. These are the main transportation. You see goats piled on top. It's very common for these taxis, which head north to south all the time. Most people, we have 150 employees nowadays at the Hospital of Hope, all Togolese. There's only one of them that owns his own car. Many of them have a motorcycle, but when they want to go out of town or go down to the capital, they'll all take one of these taxis. And I've done it as well. Sometimes it's easier to travel this way because I can get on a night taxi, one of these taxis at night, and kind of sort of sleep packed in between a whole bunch of people and arrive the next morning in Lomé, and it's a little easier than driving that road. You guys have gas stations, we have gas stations. This gas station just happens to be missing its gas pumps because it's much cheaper for them to smuggle gas across the border and sell them in the whiskey bottles than it is to have a pump out front. So your schools are always begging for more levy money, right? There you go. You can just show them this picture and say they make it work. This is an elementary and a junior high school in a village that we visited. So basically it's just these mud huts. Inside there's going to be wooden desks and a chalkboard. Very basic. Hospital and medical facilities in Togo is really a broken system as well. There have been many times we arrive at a clinic, and this is a standard type of clinic, and they're completely out of medications, or they're just got one person to staff a village of thousands of people. fast food. You guys have fast food. I get fast food every week when I go out to the villages to do our Bible studies with our chaplains. This is a standard meal, cost about $1. Hard-boiled eggs, some vegetables, and usually some. The chaplain I travel with, he's really great about saying, no, he doesn't quite want that piece of meat. And so he'll find good pieces of meat to throw on top of mine. Because if not, sometimes you'll find something. And I actually had a class. I started out University of Idaho as an agricultural education major. And so I'm one of the few people you know probably who actually had a class called Meat Sciences, where you study meat and you actually kill animals in lab. And so I have so many times looked at a pot and seen something floating on the pot and thought, I don't know where that comes from on an animal. So you want to kind of avoid those pieces. It's not uncommon to see the entire cow's like nose like floating on top of the sauce. And you're like, I think I'll skip that part. So anyway, good times. You have a minivan? I don't need a minivan. I can fit all of the boys on my motorcycle. Melissa shakes her head because usually this is when Melissa's at work because you don't see any helmets or shoes, do you? So. Anyway, no, it's a fun way to travel. Unfortunately, the boys are getting tall enough now. I can't really do this because I can't see over the front one. And when your motorcycle breaks down or your car breaks down, you need AAA. Well, it cost me $5 to have my motorcycle loaded on top of the taxi. And then Melissa and I joined the six people that were already in that taxi for a nice ride home for about $5. So. Melissa doesn't always trust my driving, and so in rainy season, you can have big sections of the road that are completely covered by water, and Melissa will kindly say, let me get off and walk through this, because it's her way of saying, I don't want to be on when you go, and try to cross this thing. And it actually helps me out, because I can watch your head and see how deep the water is. No, it's good times. We do have hippos. You know, you're always like, what are you in Africa? What do you see? My brother's an outfitter in northern Idaho, and he's like, what animals can I come and kill? I'm like, well, you can't really kill anything, but we do have hippos, so that's cool. These are all pictures thanks to a student who came out with a master's college group that came and visited us. A wonderful young man with lots of energy decided he's going to get as close as he could to the hippos. So you can't hear in the background, but I'm yelling, you know, David, that's close enough. Come back. I didn't want to be on the front of one of the master catalog's tragedies. But there's a hippo track. That's what that looks like. And we got all kinds of bugs as well. Boys and bugs. Now, we live in a Muslim town. It's 90-some percent Muslim. And so there are certain holidays that basically our whole town celebrates where animals are sacrificed, just like olden times. The most common one is Tabaski, which is their celebration of when Abraham sacrificed his son Ishmael in their story. And so for that celebration, pretty much every Muslim family will kill at least a goat or a sheep. And if they have enough money, they'll do one for every male person in their family. And so those are days when our whole town smells like burning hair, and there's just animals hanging everywhere. And those days... we don't have much refrigeration in Mongo for the most part. We do at our house, but most people don't. So those animals are killed in the morning, and by evening, they're all prepared, and they're given out. They bring, part of that celebration is to bring food to the poor or to their neighbors. So it's a great opportunity. We usually end up with lots of little morsels of food on those days. This is just one of our... Ramadan is another Muslim celebration, of course, and... we look forward to Ramadan a little bit sometimes because they have what they call Ramadan donuts. They're only served during Ramadan, and a lot of Muslims break their fast in our village with these donuts in the evening. And so for about a month or so, we have lots of Ramadan donuts because the boys kind of got addicted to them. But they're not actually sweet. They're kind of like an onion ring, I say. Without the onion, they kind of are served with this red sauce. So that's life where we're at. This is one of our hospital employees. I went out to his village. He was getting married, met his family, and saw this was the house he grew up in. And so many times I think I'm really frustrated at the work ethic sometimes, or that people that work in our hospital aren't doing something a little different. I have to remember, he grew up here. He grew up out in a field just getting enough corn for their family to survive. These tops of these little castle tops pop off, and those are actually silos where they store their grain. The top of the house is where they sleep, and the inside is where the animals are kept, and they also do some cooking when it's rainy outside. But what you notice out front are these little tower things, and each of these are an idol for an ancestor or a spirit. And so it's very common to see like chickens sacrificed on them. And these people in each of the villages I go to really live in a lot of fear. And I'm frequently frustrated when I come across people who feel somehow I'm ruining culture in Africa by sharing what I feel is a very positive message of the gospel. Because if nothing else, the fear they live in is not something that, as compassionate people, whether you're a follower of Christ or not, you should feel comfortable saying we're going to let that continue. Because they live in so much fear of spirits and evil forces, as well as curses and things like that. This is one of our hospital employees. Her husband passed away, and I went to the funeral. And the funeral, you had to follow the casket across the river, and then we all got in boats and followed across as well. And part of the funeral ceremony, they had a village witch doctor there who was throwing stones and deciding how much this family needed to pay to appease the spirits. And then to watch this family, thankfully, only have to pay for a goat, and how excited they were that it wasn't something worse and there was no curse against them. And it was just a very somber event in many ways. And then I also left feeling very discouraged, because there's so much of tribal stuff is really mixed in a lot of these villages with very dark, evil forces. And that's, I think we've seen lots of change there, but it's still, there's so much work to be done. After almost 10 years of planning, we got excited about going to Africa because we had visited another hospital, and we felt like there were so many churches and things around that hospital that we came home saying, I know there's more needs out there. And we started hearing about the Hospital of Hope Project, which was in northern Togo. Instead of being a primarily Christian culture, it's mostly Muslim. It's very, very unchurched. And so this is a $6.5 million project that was put together by ABWE to reach into a very desolate area of Togo. We arrived in Togo in time for us to help with the nurses' aides training, because when we arrived in Togo, the hospital had not yet opened. We opened in 2015. And so our children got to be dummies for the nurses' aides as they learned how to take vitals. We have a nursing class right now of 16 nursing students that we're putting through nursing training in Mongo, and then they'll be graduating in 2019 and joining our hospital. Our first class of nurses were trained at our southern hospital, which is 8 hours south, and you think Togo, but for them, it's a completely different culture. They grew up in a Christian sort of environment, 8 hours south, went through a three-year nursing program, and then moved up to Mongo to be a part of the hospital project. They don't speak our local languages, and so they are in many ways missionaries like we are. All of them were believers, and their desire was to reach the people of northern Togo as well. This class is different. This class, we said, we have to have people that speak our local languages. So we opened up the application process and said we want to have as many Christians as we could. When we started this process, we had four Christians and 13 or 14 Muslims. At least one of the Christians hasn't made it, and a couple of the Muslims. And so we're down to 16 people. But our goal is for this class to hear the gospel, to be touched by the gospel, and to have really good questions, and also, of course, to be able to enter into our hospital as productive teammates. We have a really exciting stuff here, because it's 3 years long, and so far they've already gone through an Old Testament survey, New Testament survey, because part of their nursing training is, we said, okay, well, you're Muslims, but you still have to know what we believe as a missionary team, because it's our goal that people hear the gospel. And I don't think I've ever heard as great of questions out of a group of people as these Muslim guys and ladies. They just have asked great questions about how things match up to what they've been taught. And they actually know scripture like nobody's business. Last week we had a meeting in Harrisburg, and I met up with one of our hospital administrators, and he said they had just finished a class where they invited a man to come teach these guys on, I think it was Jesus' ministry. And while they were going through that, he was trying to remember a verse, and they all repeated back to him the verse he was looking for, because they've really been studying the scriptures, trying to compare that to what they've been taught. So it's our hope and prayer that God's Spirit just really moves in this group of students, and they become some of our first, hospital employees that consider Christianity. Hope in a land of despair is kind of a tagline we added to our hospital when we opened. Because in 2015, when we opened the doors of the hospital, I don't know if you guys know this, but every year there's a survey that goes out that's called the Happiness Index. They try to determine what country is the happiest country. Anybody here ever heard of that, the Happiest Index or Happiest Survey? Okay. Yeah. Any ideas? What's the happiest country according to the survey? What's that?
Norway,
yep, exactly. It's usually Norway or Denmark or one of these superpowers where they work really long hours. No, they don't. In 2015, when this survey came out, Togo was dead last, the least happy country in the entire world. And if you had arrived in Lomé, our capital, at the bottom of Togo, and you had asked, what do you think is the least happy city in all of Togo? I am pretty sure at least half the people you talked to would have said Mongo, because where we ended up is a town where military officials and police officials, if they are under discipline and they either lose their job or have to be stationed someplace, the option is Mongo. And so I've met people out there that have been stationed in Mongo as a form of discipline. And so in 2015, when after years of groups coming out from the U.S. to help with the construction, we had a celebration where we got to open the hospital, and that was a few months after we got there. We woke up that morning. We had heard the president was coming, and when the president of Togo is coming to your event, you lose a little bit of control because his people come in and they want to make it a political rally as well. And so they brought in the night before these huge speakers, taller than me, and they were testing them out. You know, it's like on a major scale, and then all of a sudden they play music. And so we woke up that morning at 5:30 or 6 o'clock, and there was music blaring because our house is about 400 yards behind the hospital. And music is blaring, and they're playing something in English. And I'm like, what is that song? And I can hear the lyrics, and it's the lyrics of Hotel California. See, they thought, well, there's Americans here, and we have this American song. And so for 6 hours, we heard Hotel California over and over and over and over. There's a line in that song that says, this could be heaven or this could be hell. And I thought, yeah, that's pretty accurate here. I don't know which way this is going to go. No, it was a really great day, though, because we had people in Togo and in Mongo who I think had been afraid to have any hope suddenly say, there's something exciting going on, and I want to see what's going on. And so that day, as the events began, thousands of people started pouring into the hospital compound. And so when we had about 5,000 people on our grounds, the military closed the entrance and said nobody else could come in because it was unsafe for the president and things if there was more people. And at that point, if you had stepped out of the hospital grounds and looked down towards Mongo, it's about a half mile, you would have seen a road that looks like this, just crammed with people, as people were still hoping to come and see what was happening. This is a mostly Muslim town, and they knew we were Christians. And that day, we had the president speeches, we had tribal dancing, we had many missionaries speaking, and a lot of it came back to Todd DeKreiger. This is Todd. He was a physician's assistant whose dream had been to see this hospital open 10 years before this. As he joined ABW and got a lot of experience at our southern hospital, he was the push behind getting funding, getting plans in place, and opening the Hospital of Hope. And so he, even on weekends when he worked down south, he'd drive up 8 hours to make sure construction was going okay. His house is just next door to ours. So there's basically 5 or 6 houses on the hospital compound that are for the on-call people like ourselves. And so we have this phone in our house that can go off at any hour, and it does. And it's either a medical emergency or something bizarre for me to look into. So we live just next door to Todd, and Todd's mentioned that day, after all of these years of work and planning and prayers and recruiting, he had been a big part in recruiting a lot of our team. He said this was the happiest day of his life, just to see God bring this all together. So our first year, there were so many stories of what God did at the Hospital of Hope. I'm kind of skipping through a bunch of notes, so let me flip some pages here. Before I get too far into this, I want to read just a scripture passage from 1 Peter chapter 3. 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 13 says, "Now who is there to harm you if you are zealous for what is good? But even if you should suffer for righteousness' sake, you will be, or you are, depending on your translation, blessed. Have no fear of them, nor be troubled, but in your hearts regard Christ the Lord as holy, always being prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks you for the hope that is in you." Now, there's a lot in this passage, but first of all, it says, who's going to harm you if you're zealous for what is good? It's a rhetorical question, and it implies, as Christians, because Peter was writing to Christians who are suffering for their faith, that we should be people who are passionate for what is good. But also, the rhetorical question part of that says, well, no one's going to harm you if you're doing what's good. No harm should come to you. But it says, but even if you should suffer for righteousness' sake, you will be, or you are, blessed. And I think this is important because, yes, this was a verse written to people persecuted for their faith, but there are things in this passage which I think apply to all of our lives. No matter how difficult the days or the events we walk through, we are blessed people. When you are called of Christ, into a relationship, and we have that as part of our DNA of our faith. As followers of Christ, we enter even difficult situations as blessed people. That first year, there were many reminders of that because we have a team. We started, we hired 126 Togolese employees to begin with. We're up to about 150 some right now. And then we had a team of about 30 or 40 Americans from all over. And, well, I shouldn't say just Americans, expats. So we have a lady and her husband. She's a doctor and he's an agriculturist. They're from France. We have our pharmacist is from New Zealand. We had at that point at least one family from Canada. And then, of course, a lot of people from all across the states. And we have had a lot of, at times, struggle because, you know, even in a church where we all believe exactly the same, there's still differences, isn't there? And we quickly realize we're Northwest people. Well, we think differently than some people in the East Coast or Canadians. So we were excited to work with this team, but it wasn't all roses. And that's how it is everywhere, right? We come together as a church family. We have to say, what's really important? Well, we're blessed people. This first year, we saw 15,000 patients the first year. Do you want to talk a little bit about Gracie?
Sure.
Kind of just threw this picture in there. I forgot about this one.
Yeah, no. So I think this picture of Gracie is kind of illustrates a little bit about how that hospital melds the two ministries, and it fits a little bit into kind of that blessed people because of the results. Gracie was a premature baby born, I think she was about 30 weeks or so. She was born about a couple months early, and her mom wasn't able to care for her, so her grandmother stayed with her, and it was touch and go with Gracie for a while. And after, she stayed in her hospital for several months until she got strong enough and was gaining weight and could go home with grandma. And during that time, we poured into grandma's life and Gracie's life. Our chaplains got to know Gracie's family. And she comes from a village about 45 minutes away from the hospital, mostly Muslim. And there had been another patient from that village, too, who had had surgery. Todd had done some surgery on him. And there was a little Bible study kind of forming in that village. And so the chaplains went back after Gracie was discharged, followed up with the family and with that Bible study that was kind of struggling along. And then we would go out and see Gracie from time to time. She would come in and see us, seemed to be gaining weight and doing well. And about a year ago, she was a couple months old. I was in clinic one day, and they called me from reception and said, come, there's a baby here, and the baby's really sick. And I went down there and saw immediately Grandma and Gracie, and Gracie was not doing well. And so I picked Gracie up and ran for our ER area and called the doctors on call who were there, and they worked on her for several hours. I went back to the chaplain office, and our chaplains are from our area. There's three men and two women, and they speak our heart language, the languages of the North, and one of them had really invested in Gracie's family. And I called him, and he came and was with Gracie's grandmother. She watched the doctors work on Gracie. And after about 3 hours or so, Gracie passed away. And it was devastating because we had poured so much into Gracie and in Gracie's family. We thought, Lord, it seemed like such a waste. And I thought, Lord, what are you going to do here? Because I can't see good. They took Gracie's body back to her village, and they asked permission of the elders, the chiefs in that village, if they could have a funeral service for her, which is unusual for a baby. Usually babies are buried in the cornfields because they die so often. They're really not counted as much until they get older. And the chiefs and the elders discussed this, and they said yes. And the chaplain said it would be a Christian burial service. And they said that's still okay. And there was about 30 of these chiefs and elders that came to Gracie's funeral service, and the gospel was shared there. And that Bible study right now is over 100 people, and including some of those chiefs and those elders. And as I look back and I think, Lord, Gracie's life was so short, and yet it really illustrates what God can do, even with a life that was so brief.
Thank you. Yeah. So we are a part of a hospital ministry. I didn't mention this real well. It is a ministry that is passionate about doing good for some of the poorest people in Togo. And that's enough for some people. It's not enough for us. We said we want to be involved in a ministry that is actively planting churches. And that is, our team up north has had a different philosophy because we've seen philosophies modeled in other cultures that don't work in our culture. And that is for a missionary to go out and start a church. And so instead we say the hospital is our church generating engine. And then our chaplains are our frontline people, and then we're spiritual coaches, if you will. And so I visit, Tuesday is my day, and sometimes on Sundays, there's two villages I visit. I kind of adopted like a people group, and so there's three villages. On Tuesday, I go with one of our chaplains. He leads the Bible study. We're doing a kind of a chronological Bible study. At the end of that, then we slip into more of a study on how to grow as a Christian. But it's people who have never, ever heard the gospel. And so as they hear that in their heart language, our chaplain uses a translator in that village. So he's speaking French so I can understand it. And he's translating it into Gom Gom, or speaking in French. And this translator is taking it from French to Gom Gom, the local village language. And in the process, we are building two people, because I'm listening to our chaplain, making sure we're coaching him on how to teach and what's spiritually accurate or scripturally accurate. But then our translator, who is somebody we've chosen as possibly a village leader at some point, is hearing that in French and translating that into Gom Gom and being the face of that message to his people, setting him up, if he continues as a follower of Christ, to be the leader of that small group. So it's kind of our vision that the hospital has a bigger deal than just being passionate about helping the poor and the sick. Let's see here. You know, the first year there's all kinds of different stories, but one that sticks out is a young man named Maurice. He's 19 years old, and playing soccer, he says in a little video clip we got of him, soccer was his life. He was practicing soccer one day, about an hour from our hospital, and somehow broke both of the bones in his lower leg. His family was off on a trip to the capital in Lome, wouldn't be back for several days, so his sister and other relatives helped him back to his home, where he laid on a bed. Village healer came, sister brought him food, but when his family returned several days later, they realized Maurice needed medical help, and so they loaded him into a taxi and took him to a clinic, where quickly the clinic said, we can't do anything, he has to go to a hospital. And so hours later, he arrived at our hospital days after having been injured, and the surgeon looked at his leg and said, to save his life, he has to lose his leg. And so they took off his leg, and in this picture, I don't usually post photos on our photo blog of our patients, but this time I did, because I was standing there as the surgeon was announcing to the patient once again, the infection was worse than they thought, and his leg had to come off a little bit higher. His family is at this point arrived, and they're distraught, thinking if we'd only been home. And this young man, 19 years old, fighting back tears, all he can imagine is, in the States, sometimes you can have a normal life without a limb. But he's never seen someone that doesn't have a leg that has a life. The only people he's ever seen without a leg are the people that hop up to the taxis as they come through the taxi station, begging for the small coins that will allow him to survive. And so that's what he's thinking. My life is finished. But over the days that followed, the hospital ministry really is a lot of the chaplains. They visited each day offering to pray. At first he was kind of stoic, eventually started opening up a bit. They shared with him the gospel message. And twice a day we play the Jesus film, which is kind of, for people that have never heard the story of the Bible, a great overview. Then they followed through every day after that. Is there questions you have about this? Quickly, Maurice started changing. He wanted to know about the message he was hearing. Who is this Jesus guy? And he started doing Bible studies with our chaplains. And as he was discharged from the hospital to a little building outside where he slept and then just came to the hospital each day to have his dressings changed, Maurice spent more than a month with us. And during that time, he became an excited follower of Christ. He'd read through the whole New Testament by the time he left, and some of the books multiple times. And so as he went back to his village, and we talked with him and said, you know, you need to be home for a certain number of weeks, and then at that point you'll be eligible to get a prosthesis, because it has to take some time. And we offered as a hospital to help pay for him to get a prosthesis. It was at a different facility. And so before I left, I had the opportunity to go and see Maurice at that facility where he got his prosthesis. And that was exciting, but more exciting was to hear Maurice's life. It's changed. Maurice told our Togolese chaplain, he said, it's worth losing what I lost, his leg, to gain what he gained, his new life. See, he faces life, even as someone without a leg, understanding he's now a blessed person. He understands having that relationship is really much more important than what he lost. And he asked one of our missionary friends, do you think it's ever possible that someone without a leg could be a pastor? He has a heart. He has a heart to see his village and his family brought to Christ. And so those are the type of moments that make us super excited, because we do see a lot of death at our hospital, a lot of death. It's very somewhat common for Melissa to lose 3 patients in a night, and that's been a struggle at times as well. Well, after we had finished 1 year of having the hospital open, from grand opening to 1 year later, we had seen roughly 15,000 patients in that 1 year, including the clinic that we had, and a lot of great stories. So we started planning a 1 year celebration to help point our Muslim employees back to the fact that God is the only reason we, as a brand new staff and a brand new team, had made it through this entire year. But about 10 days before 10 days before that grand opening celebration, Todd DeKreiger got sick, and so he was not feeling well, and we thought, well, he's been at this wedding, he probably ate the wrong food there. He treated himself for a lot of different things. He treated himself for malaria, and then typhoid, and then food poisoning, and he wasn't getting better, and so he lives next door, and Melissa was asked to come over and look at him. A couple other doctors dropped in, and it was decided he really needed to go to the hospital. And within a day or two, we said, you know, he's not getting better, he's not responding to meds, we need to start the air evacuation process. And so we started a process. We borrowed a van from the military camp across the way, this huge ambulance, and we retrofitted it so it could fit a large American doctor. Todd was 6'3" and a big Dutch guy. And so we got this ambulance all hooked up. In the wee hours of the morning, we loaded him in, and I followed with my van and Todd's wife and Todd's father-in-law here. And we headed out of town to meet up with the airplane about an hour and a half away that was going to take Todd to Germany to get medical care. And about a half hour into that, our ambulance just stopped. They put up the hood and quickly said, okay, the serpentine belt's broke. It's something that you kind of need if you have a car, I guess, and don't carry extras. And for some reason, I didn't have a tow strap. And so the first thought was, well, maybe we'll transfer him to our van and try to get there in time with the van. And then we said, well, there's so many medical people around him and he's not doing that well. Let's try to find somebody to tow us. And so in this country where everything is, if it's usable, it's taken. And beside the roads, people walk beside the roads and gather up things that might have fallen off traffic so they can use them. Somehow, and if you've been to one of these countries, you'll understand this is nearly a miracle. We found a strap, like a tow strap type of thing, about 14 feet long, and a piece of rope that we said, well, together we could probably wind these together, and this could possibly pull this ambulance. And so we tried waving down a couple of trucks as they came by, and they left their brakes in Europe, and so a couple of them didn't stop, and I didn't hold it against them. But the third one did stop, and to this day, it was one of the best. Well, first I tried hooking my van to it and realized my van wouldn't quite pull that because it was a heavy ambulance. But the last truck that came was in such great condition. I was like, wow. And the driver was very willing to try this ordeal, this great crazy plan of towing this ambulance for the last hour or so through a mountain pass, through potholes and things like that. And he didn't even ask for money, which is, if you live in Africa, is another near miracle. And somehow we arrived in Kara for our air transport. And that's the team of us excited saying, wow, God brought us here. We still made it in time, and somehow all of this worked out despite what seemed like huge problems. And that's that rope that towed that ambulance and didn't break. And there was, I mean, moments when you're going through potholes and they didn't even smash into each other. And we really left there saying, God is doing something amazing. And as Todd's father-in-law stood on the airport and just prayed for his daughter and her husband as they flew to Germany, we were hopeful. Is God going to do something amazing here? We returned to the hospital and called a whole team meeting and our hospital team, and we just fell on our faces before the Lord saying, God, get them there safely. May he recover quickly. And hours later, Jennifer called back and said they had made it, but to keep praying. Todd wasn't doing well. And later that evening, wee hours of the morning, Melissa and I, we're next door with the two DeKreiger boys. They have four boys. Their youngest is the same age as our oldest. And so we sat at the DeKreiger's table, and then as Jennifer through Facebook told her boys, I'm sorry, your father's passed away. Now that was a hit for our team because Todd had been the one that recruited so many of us. It was Todd's vision this hospital even go forward. And so in the days that followed, as we prepared to remember Todd's life and to bury him there in Togo as he'd wish, we also discovered that he'd passed away of Lassa fever, which is similar to Ebola. And so we also then realized, well, we have this unknown disease on our hands. And then the nurse that primarily took care of Todd was Andreas. He was a nurse out with our hospital with Samaritan's Purse, and he became ill as well. And so we quickly air-evac'd him through Samaritan's Purse back to the United States, where he spent roughly two months recovering at a CDC facility from Lassa fever. All of this to say, there's part of his evacuation. So our one-year celebration didn't really happen. In fact, instead, Todd passed away to the day, one day after we opened. And looking at it, you say, why? What's happening here? But, you know, as I look at it, also I say, God is showing us in some ways. His work continues. No matter how great we think each of us are or how important each of us are, God's will is going to continue. His path is written out. And we had to decide at that point, you know, in this scripture it says, first of all, we're zealous for what is good. But then it also says that in our hearts we have to just rely on, regard Christ as holy. So going through difficult times, we first of all realize who we are. We're blessed people. But then also where our strength comes from. That's in who we are and who has called us. And so we, at that point, kind of fell on our faces and said, God, help us. We don't know where to go now. We have so many people discouraged. And the next year, we continued on. Todd was our main surgical coverage. And so for that whole entire next year, we somehow had surgeons just volunteer to come and fill in the gaps. We never went a day without surgical coverage at our hospital. And at the end of the second year, Jennifer DeKreiger had an opportunity. We said, let's not have a huge celebration, but let's invite all of our employees and our close friends. And we had 400 or 500 people there, as Jennifer was able to then tell them what Todd had given his life for and how they viewed Todd as sacrificing his life by coming to Africa, getting sick and dying. But she said, really, it's just to help you all see that there's someone much bigger who's given his life, died, so that you could have life. And it was a powerful time for them, I think, to understand a little bit of what Jesus' sacrifice really means. I mentioned our hospital's ministry is the chaplaincy. We have American missionaries as well as Togolese that work side by side as our chaplain group. And we show the Jesus film both to families and our patients. In Togo, if you're at the hospital and you're hospitalized, you bring a family member with you because there's no cafeteria. So they camp out there and they make your meals. They do a lot of other things that nurses' aides and things do in the States. And so you have an opportunity at our hospital not just to minister to the patients, but to an entire family. And what we've seen is sometimes the most effective ministry has happened in our surgery patients. Because someone comes for a surgery, they're there for a month. And the first thing they realize is, wow, things are different here. All tribes are treated the same. You get admitted to our hospital whether you can afford the service or not. In most Togolese hospitals, you will die outside the hospital if you don't have money to pay for your services. So you can be urgent, you know, arm flopping around, and if you don't have the money to go in, they don't let you in. So that's another difference. We treat everyone the same. We try to cover all needs that come to our door. We've had an opportunity as a team to speak into a couple different crises as well. This is a refugee camp that's less than an hour from our hospital that kind of just grew out of nowhere because a whole tribe was being, chased out of their entire region. And so they set up camp, and later the UN moved in. But we had the first opportunity to come and show Christ's love to them, did medical rotations through that camp, and then provided them with rice and clean water for a few days till the UN stepped in. But I mentioned that the heart of our ministry is really the village ministry. And the Bible studies we've started in villages. When we left, there was 8 rural villages that had Bible studies going on. And then in Mongo itself, there's probably another 6 or 8, which are the Muslim-based groups as well. Those village ministries, Melissa mentioned Fare, is that one where baby Gracie was. It's over 100 people. Most of those are 11 to 15 people. And then we have one that's 45 or so, and it's kind of already graduated into a church. And so that's our vision, is to see these groups of people that originally are just kind of hearing about what is the gospel eventually turn into a God-honoring local congregation. We do use a lot of facilities like our tools. This is the Creation to Christ, I think, or maybe a Story of Hope, but just visuals to help people understand. This is an interesting picture because in this picture, Mr. Amidou, one of our chaplains, is explaining to these Muslim men the Christians or the Bible's view or the story of Abraham sacrificing his son Isaac. So that would be a very hard one to describe to a Muslim because they think of the story from the Quran as Abraham sacrificing Ishmael. Yeah. And then as we do these Bible studies, we get through a lot of the Old Testament. We introduce who Jesus is. At that point in a village Bible study, most times we will then project the Jesus film for 1 or 2 nights in the village. And those events sometimes have 300, 400, 500 people come to them. And that's just kind of, it's meant to help our group see visually who Jesus is, but also turns into kind of an outreach for them to invite people to come to this event. That's one of the Bible studies I'm involved with every Tuesday morning in one of our villages, about a half hour by motorcycle from the hospital. And it's this gentleman here, he was a surgery patient who came to Christ and said, please come back to my village and tell them what you've taught me. And so out of that grew this group. And this tool here is a little radio you can buy in our market for about $8, and it has an SD card slot on the side. And I can get the whole New Testament in Gom Gom, which is their tribal language, on that SD card. And so we load it on the SD card, give them the radio with the SD card, and when we go there to teach a lesson, we tell them what scripture reference we're going to go through, and they play that first in Gom Gom, and then we teach after that. And then it's also fun to see that many times they've been listening through the Bible between my Tuesday sessions, and they'll have lots of questions when we get there. What's this we heard in this passage? So it's kind of fun because it's an oral culture, so most of them don't read, but we still have a tool now with SD cards and things like that to share the gospel. And then in each of these small rural villages, we try to bring their leaders into our training facility there in Mongo once a month, and these gentlemen come in, and we try to nurture them and coach them along in becoming what we hope will be eventually church leaders in each of those villages. We've had baptisms. We went to this one. This is Ancien. He's one of our chaplains. And they did a baptism here in the hippo pond, and we discovered the hippo pond basically has a stream bed through the middle, but the rest of it's only about that deep. So it makes baptisms a little tricky because you kind of got to push them down if you want them all the way under. There was great debate. Do we roll him over or do we just push him down further? So, just in closing, this is Gom Gom Grandpa. This gentleman, as he left our hospital, had been one of our longer patients. He spent 4 or 5 months with us. He came to us as a Muslim leader in his mosque. He had retired as a school teacher and was a leader in a mosque and came. And he turned into the most joyous man who was so excited to read through the scriptures and to debate and talk about the scriptures. And after 5 months, he was passionate about seeing his family understand the story of hope that he had discovered at our hospital. 3 or 4 days before he was supposed to return to his village, there was a little entourage of men from his little local mosque who brought him a piece of paper and said, "You're coming back. You're probably going to want to be a leader in our mosque. We just need you to sign this, and then you can come back in." And it was a form that said, "I understand. You know, I denounce my Christian faith. I only said that so I get better service here," because they assume you get better service at the hospital if you're a Christian, because we're a Christian hospital. And he got irate. He said, "You know, I'm 70 years old. I don't make decisions without thinking through these a lot, and I can think on my own." He said, "I saw here people treated the same, whether they were Muslim or Christian or animist." And he said, "And in addition to that, I understand the Bible, and I've weighed it out with Scripture and with the Quran, and I'm a Christ follower for those reasons." And so he didn't sign their form, and then he told them, "In addition to that, I go back to my village, and I want to have a meeting, but my meeting is going to be in my house. It's going to start with my family and my neighbors, but anybody can come, but I want people to hear the hope that I have found here." And so that's the exciting part, is that we are making a dent, I think, in some of the Muslim towns around us, and there's so much more work to do, because honestly, it's much easier to share the gospel with an animistic village and develop Christian followers there than it is in a lot of our Muslim facilities. Jennifer DeKreiger and the boys, if you're curious, they are still feeling it. God called them to Togo. It wasn't Todd's calling, it was a family calling. And so they've moved back and they continue to be involved. Jennifer's one of our chaplains. And then also the boys, during the summer, they all have jobs. One of them works in the pharmacy, a couple of them in pharmacy, one in the laboratory, and then one in the surgery area. Will's going to start college this fall, either at Cedarville or Masters, and his goal is to return as a physician to a medical field somewhere in missions. I say that because we've seen God do some amazing things. We've hurt as a team. We've hurt as our fellow teammates have gone through deep and hard times. We've lost 2 teammates in our 2 years out there who have passed away on the field. And those are hard things to go through. But we've face them understanding that we're blessed people and that God's called us there to do his work and that we're called to share hope even in the middle of very difficult times. I want to just end with a paragraph that Jennifer wrote to all of us in an email the day Todd passed away, because I think it well describes how we face hard, difficult times. We face it as Christians. We face it relying on Jesus Christ. And we face it showing hope to the world. Jennifer wrote, "Today Jesus called Todd home from the work he was doing, planting and harvesting in Togo. Todd poured out his life as an offering to God in Togo. I know that Todd would similarly encourage us who remain here for a little while longer to also be faithful in the service to our King. My heart is overwhelmed with unspeakable grief for myself, for our boys, our extended family, and the Hospital of Hope team. I cling only to the gospel and to the certain hope of our salvation through Jesus Christ. Even in my pain, I believe that our sacrifice, that Todd's sacrifice, was worth it. I believe that the Great Commission is a cause worth dying for. And in my midst of my grief, I fix my eyes on Jesus, the author and finisher of my faith." A great testimony. We have time for a couple questions? Okay. Are there any questions? Yes, ma'am.
I simply cannot resist because I think you may have encountered them. There's a couple serving in Cameroon that my church in Temecula sent out in around 2000-2001. So they've been there a while. They're with Wycliffe.
Okay.
And spent a lot of time in the whole area producing the Jesus film in local languages.
Yeah.
Joe and Donna Ryder.
I've not encountered them. One of our great resources is our chaplain department, because a lot of the work that's done in a lot of different organizations is kind of all put together.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a whole, like, that's when I go into the chaplain's office at the hospital, we've got it basically labeled by people groups. And then we have Jesus film, and there are so many other great things still coming out on teaching Muslims, on teaching in West Africa in oral culture. You know, we look at their school and we think Africans are not intelligent. Well, they're just intelligent in a very different way because it's very oral. And so I can teach them orally and they will remember things that I don't often remember. So, no, I greatly appreciate the Jesus film.
I'm just curious, have you ever had concern about retaliation from the leading Muslims?
Yeah, no, our Muslims in our area, we would say, are fairly friendly. They view our hospital as their hospital because we treat them all equally. But you're right, an hour north of us is a very, very strict Muslim town. And from there on, I mean, Burkina Faso, just hours above us, there have been missionaries that have been abducted. And so, yes, we are forced to do security training, which reminds us that we live in a dangerous area. And we do have a group of 30 or 40 Americans, the biggest group that north, far north in Africa, that I know of right now. So we are a target, and we understand that, but exactly. Yep. Maybe that's what it's going to take to win. Yeah.
I watch debates between Christians and Muslims. It seems like most of the leading Muslims believe that the Bible has been corrupted over the centuries. Is that something you encounter?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
That's their biggest argument. It's hard to argue with that sometimes, but at the same time, I can ask almost any of my Muslim people. In a Muslim village like Mongo, it's all relational. So I can go any night of the week pretty much under a tree and talk with men about religion or politics, and they're pretty well versed. But most of them know very, very little about the Quran. And so even if they go to mosque, they just know what their imam tells them. So it's an interesting conversation to have. But we originally started, there's a method called the bridge method where you're supposed to help people understand this is, you know, what Islam teaches and this is what Christianity teaches and this is the bridge between them. But we kind of abandoned that early on because we realized they don't understand what Islam teaches, so why teach them their own religion? So, yeah. Yes, ma'am.
Was it hard to settle in Togo right away?
Was it hard to settle in Togo right away?
I would say no. I'd say language school for us was very difficult. It was a beautiful place to live, but it was very hard. And so I think after a year and a half, we were so thankful to get to the level that was required of us that we got to Togo and we didn't look back. And so we kind of just got right into things. And we live in a house that has running water and electricity right behind the hospital. And so it really hasn't been terribly difficult to adjust. It's a little hot sometimes, but
we did add air conditioning to our house about a year after it.
Our bedroom is air conditioned. And so sometimes during hot season, we all boys guess.
I still miss ice cream, though. Yes, sir.
How much difficulty do you have with converts who want to add back animism and Muslim teaching with Christianity?
That will be and continues to be one of our biggest challenges, is trying to show them the difference. That is a problem, especially with the animistic culture. They're used to adding Catholicism or whatever else to what they believe. And honestly, even where we're at, it's called folk Muslim. And so a lot, like all of the Muslim people in our area also have a marabu, which is their version of a witch doctor. He's a Muslim witch doctor, but he's a witch doctor, which wouldn't kind of be unheard of here. So they've added that to it. So that's the biggest challenge we face, is how to draw them out of that to something completely different. And I think only time will help us figure out that. Well, at the hospital, we always need help as far as workers. And honestly, if you know medical people that would like to come out, nurses, doctors, and also maintenance people. Like many times I've said the biggest need we have is for someone to help keep the generator going, because our generator and oxygen creator go down.
Boiler, sterilizer.
Yeah, there's all kinds of. So pray for help, and then also just pray for unity, and that God would open the eyes of those that are really blinded by the God of this world.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
If you.
Thank you for that sharing. That was tremendous. They have a prayer letter sign-up sheet back here and prayer cards. Avail yourselves of those things as we depart. Let me close in prayer. Thank you for your grace that you show to all of us and around the world, that the gospel is not limited. And Lord, you are all-powerful. Thank you for this testimony as we've seen the work you're doing through these fellow believers. In Jesus' name, amen.